referred to as Dancing Bear. By this appeal, Dancing Bear is challenging the lower court's decision to dismiss Dancing Bear's complaint for failure to state a claim under Colorado Rule Civil Procedure 12b-5. As the record makes clear, this case involves many prior proceedings, several parties, and a good number of large documents and pleadings. However, this entire dispute boils down to a key set of facts. Those key set of facts, which took place at the outset of the party's business relationship, cannot be ignored or rejected. Those facts form the basis for Dancing Bear's entitlement to relief in this case. Now, first, I'd like to very briefly go through those facts, and next, I'd like to discuss why the lower court's decision was incorrect. Very briefly, Dancing Bear entered into a written loan agreement with the bank to obtain a $58 million loan in order to build a luxury private residence club in Aspen. Under the written documents, there was a budget showing how the $58 million would be spent. Shortly after the parties entered into the written agreements, they together agreed orally to change the project's direction. They decided to build a better, more expensive project that could compete with the other top clubs in Aspen. This change in direction required an upgrading of the design, the furniture, the fixtures, and the equipment. In other words, it would cost more money. More money than was in the $58 million budget under the written loan documents. Nevertheless, the bank told Dancing Bear...
And did you create a new budget?
We did, Your Honor.
And how much money would that have cost?
I don't have that exact number. I don't have that exact number, Your Honor. It's in the...
Go ahead.
Nonetheless, the bank told Dancing Bear to go ahead and build the better, more expensive project. And the parties would deal with the shortfall later on, because as all parties were now fully aware, the original $58 million was insufficient to complete the new, more expensive project. And every month, when Dancing Bear needed money, it submitted a written draw request to the bank, a very detailed request. The request not only asked for a disbursement of loan proceeds, it also told the bank what the money was being used for. So the bank was fully aware that the loan proceeds were not being used to build the project as contemplated under the written loan documents. The loan proceeds were being used to build the better, more expensive project. And in these written draw requests, the new budget was attached.
Counsel, when did these events occur in relation to the written amendments to the loan agreements?
Prior to the written loan amendments. Early 2007 is when Dancing Bear formally prepared the new budget and gave it to the bank. The amendments, I believe, were entered into in 2008 or 2009. Yeah. Further, every month, an independent construction consultant reviewed the draw requests on behalf of the bank. The independent construction consultant every month told the bank that the $58 million in the original budget was insufficient to complete the new, more expensive project that was being built. Nonetheless, the bank complied with each draw request and advanced all of the loan proceeds. This course of conduct went on for almost 2 years as Dancing Bear built the better, more expensive project. And during this time, Dancing Bear was asking the bank, how will the shortfall be resolved? You've told us it will be resolved, but how? Initially, the bank said, "We will provide the funds to plug the gap." Then the bank came back and said, "We cannot provide the funds. You, Dancing Bear, need to go out and obtain third-party financing." So Dancing Bear went out and obtained a number of proposals and submitted those proposals to the bank. The bank rejected every one. The bank then told Dancing Bear they would increase the credit line by $15 million. They then turned around and said they could not get confirmation from the head office in Germany. Significantly, the managing director of the bank's worldwide hospitality group wrote an internal email to the higher-ups of the bank questioning the... Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, what does all this matter when in 2009 enter into written loan amendments that indicate, hey, we're not relying on any other representations or agreements other than what's reflected in this writing?
Your Honor, the loan amendments, which is what you're referring to, is not a bar to a fraud claim.
It's not a bar to fraud for which the conduct was already known to the people before they signed the amendments?
Correct, Your Honor. Intentional misconduct, recklessness, or gross negligence cannot be insulated by a contractual release under New York law.
It cannot be waived, even if you know about what the conduct is.
It cannot, Your Honor.
So, but you must prove reliance. It can't just be a fraudulent representation. You must prove reliance. And in the loan agreements, which you as a sophisticated party signed, you said you were not relying on anything outside the documents. You want to go back on that.
We do not, Your Honor. At that time, when we signed the original loan documents, there was already a budget set for the $58 million.
No, the loan amendments in 2009 say you're not relying on anything outside the documents.
Can I backtrack, Your Honor? As we prepared the new project, we exhausted the $58 million. The bank then turns around and says, "We are going to revert back to the written documents," as though the plan to build the more expensive project did not exist. So that left us in a position where the bank had changed its position and was now relying on the written agreements, when for almost 2 years they had dispersed loan proceeds and watched as we built a better project.
All right, so the bank says, "We're going to stand on our legal rights under the written contracts that we've entered into and foreclose." Under what authority is that duress under New York law?
Well, Your Honor, it's the position that their conduct put us in. As I stated in the beginning, the budget was for $58 million that was to build a certain project. The parties, by their words and conduct, decided to build a more expensive project. When the original $58 million ran out, the bank did not provide more money, did not allow Dancing Bear to obtain third-party financing to plug the gap, and reverted back to the original plan.
And so all of this happens before the loan amendments?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you enter into the loan amendments, which say you're not relying upon anything outside the loan amendments. You're not relying on that, we're going forward. In other words, it sounds like you had a little problem here, you worked it out through the loan amendments, but you don't want to be bound by the loan amendments. I mean, what am I missing?
Your Honor, we had no choice but to enter into the loan amendments.
You had a choice, you could have defaulted. That's economic duress, but under New York law, that's not deemed duress.
And you could have sued, couldn't you, for fraud?
Well,
couldn't you
fraud happened 2 years earlier.
We were in control of the project. We obtained the land entitlements in Aspen. This was our idea. We were under the understanding that we were working hand in hand with the bank to build this project. We didn't want to sue. We wanted to finish the project as contemplated, as the parties agreed at the beginning of the relationship.
So there's a discussion between economic duress and legal duress. What's the difference in your mind between those two here? Do you view them as one and the same, or under New York law, what's the difference here?
I do believe they are different. The economic duress is what Dancing Bear was under when it signed the loan amendments.
But what's the legal duress then?
There was nowhere else to turn. There was no other option at that point for Dancing Bear. It wasn't. It would be a loss of their work for over 3 years, and the hard work of the contractors that were at the project. There was no other choice.
Okay. Well, you had the choice to sue for fraud if you thought you'd been defrauded. I grant you, you didn't want to do it, but that was an option. In fact, that's what you're trying to do now.
Correct, Your Honor.
But it was an option years ago. And instead of choosing that, you chose the loan amendments instead. Again, sophisticated business parties here. You wait years, you work things out through the loan amendments, and now you want to say, never mind.
We were only in that position because the bank misled us for 2 years. We were only put into that position, not through any fault of our own. We were put into that position to enter into that loan agreement, into the loan amendment. Reckless conduct cannot be insulated by a contractual release. At the very least, the bank's conduct toward us was reckless. For the 2 years in which they encouraged us to build a better project, and then turned around and reverted back to the original plan. I'd respectfully like to request some time for rebuttal.
You got it. 3 minutes, 17 seconds, sir.
Good afternoon. Bridget Johnson of Sidley Austin LLP in Los Angeles for Portagon.
Did you enter a Pro Hoc VJ as well?
I did enter a Pro Hoc VJ, and I was actually about to. I am admitted Pro Hoc VJ, and my registration number is 751451. And we represent the appellee, what is now known as Portagon AG, but they were formerly known as West LB, which is how they've been referred in the brief, so I'll refer to them that way. Your Honor is correctly focus on what is the key issue here with respect to the issues on appeal, which is that there were a set of agreements that governed the relationship between these parties. The appellant is misconstruing the agreements early on. There was an agreement to loan $58 million. It had a budget attached. As referenced in the complaint, that budget was changed. The contractors were hired after the fact. Therefore, the budget amounts could not be finalized in any event until several months after the parties entered into the loan agreement. And therefore,
aren't we looking at the allegations in the light most favorable to the plaintiff?
You are, but the plaintiff makes these allegations. First of all, the loan agreement is under consideration here. The plaintiff hasn't challenged that the loan agreement, the loan amendments, and the pre-negotiation agreements are part of the record here due to their reference in the complaint. In addition, the complaint specifically, when it goes through the lengthy history of the parties, some of which have been referred to here already, it talks about the actual order of operations here, that the agreement gets entered into for $58 million. There are budgets attached, the budgets get changed, they go over budget, notwithstanding, they go over the revised budget. The budget does not have any bearing on how much was required to be owed. The agreements, all of them, contained no oral modification clauses. To be modified, there had to be a written agreement. If that $58 million loan amount was going to be increased, it had to be done by a written agreement.
Well, counsel, this no oral modification clause, I mean, in my experience, it's kind of questionable whether those are worth the paper they're written on. So there's so many exceptions to that in the law that notwithstanding such a provision, parties can nevertheless agree to modify their agreements and act pursuant to that modified agreement. And once they act pursuant to that, a party may be estopped to rely on a no oral modification agreement. And hasn't that been alleged here?
That is alleged here. New York law recognizes and enforces a no oral modification clause. New York law does recognize an exception for either partial performance or estoppel. But what is alleged here to have been the partial performance or estoppel is the fact that WestLB continued to fund the loan amounts in response to the draw request. All of that, those actions are completely in line with the original loan agreements.
So has it been alleged that the amounts that were being drawn for construction were still within the original $58 million?
That is correct.
But that was alleged in the complaint.
It is.
We're limited to the complaint.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of the complaint is that we wouldn't give them more. So yes, it's alleged that the loan was for 50, I mean, well, the agreement says it too, but the loan is for $58 million. They submitted draw requests, and up until about 2008, those draw requests were all granted until they had exhausted the entire $58 million. The only amounts that were ever released beyond that were subject to the loan amendments. There was an almost $12 million additional amount that was part of escrow funds for sales of the fractional share units that WestLB was entitled to, but in an effort to try and resolve the situation through the loan amendments, WestLB released those funds. At the time when WestLB released the funds, that is when there was the insistence that the parties agree to the releases and several representations and agreements in the loan amendments. We're all well aware of the releases. There's been no challenge that the releases govern the scope of these claims, if enforceable. There was a reaffirmation of the fact that there could be no oral modification.
Actually, I thought there was a challenge. I thought that the challenge was that the release will not cover prior fraudulent or reckless conduct.
There is a legal challenge based on a line of cases that concern exculpatory provisions, which one are arguably not even applicable here, that all the cases, the Kalish case and the various other cases cited by the appellant do not apply to releases. And on top of it, what they, again, you have to focus on what it is that they're saying is the fraud. The fraud focuses on the fact that they say that WestLB promised to either loan them more money, somehow resolve this shortfall, or consent to third-party financing. And all the agreements are clear that the loan amount was $58 million. There was nothing, and appellant has never pointed to anything that said that there was some obligation for WestLB to loan more than $58 million. The loan agreements explicitly state that the appellant cannot incur any further debt. And the argument that appellant has made that somehow that can be interpreted as WestLB being obligated to, in good faith, approve further third-party financing does not comport with the legal interpretation of agreement, all of which can be determined on motion dismiss, and which was what Judge Nichols did down below when she considered all of this. So the fact is there's a long line of cases that say you can't create a fraud claim from what is basically a contractual situation. If the contract says you're not obligated to do this or you can't do this, you can't then base a fraud claim on those exact same provisions saying, well, you said you were going to do this, but you know, notwithstanding the fact that you're not required to do it under the contract, I'm going to say that I'm going to allege fraud. There's thousands of cases in New York, many of which we cited in our brief, that explicitly reject a fraud claim in that circumstances. There can be no reliance. You have to have reliance for a fraud claim in New York and everywhere else. There can be no reliance here by the appellants because they knew and fully understood the exact circumstances. They knew that they needed to have a written agreement. The allegations in the complaint confirmed this. There are allegation after allegation talking about Mr. Devenir calling WestLB, saying, will you meet with me? We need to talk about more money, about us making an agreement. There is the complaint specifically recognizes the fact that a further agreement was necessary if there were to be more money, approval of third-party financing, or some other financial accommodation. Then once you get to the loan amendments, that becomes even more clear. There are explicit provisions that say appellant did not rely on any of the representations.
Let's go back to a question opposing counsel posited, like, what were they supposed to do? What was their choice by the time the loan amendments came in? If they were in so strapped, were they to stop work and start a lawsuit? Were they just to, just stop everything and start a lawsuit? Is this something other than economic duress, being able to, assert your legal rights?
There are a number of other options in the borrower-lender relationship. They could have invested more equity. That was one of the plans. They could have found third-party financing that was acceptable to...
I thought the argument was, no matter what third-party financing they came up with, it got rejected.
What they allege is that they came up with third-party financing and it was rejected. West LB was not under any obligation to accept the third-party financing. That doesn't mean if they had come up with the third-party financing that they found basically would only pay a third of what was owed to West LB and then put the rest of the security interest at the same level, par passu, with the new lender. So that's obviously not acceptable. I understand what you're asking, but I guess one could posit a question back. What is West LB supposed to do? They're owed over $60 million, which notably was never paid. When West LB did foreclose on the property, they obviously recovered some degree, but only about 60-70% of the amount that was owed. It is not in a borrower-lender relationship. There's no special relationship there. It's a contractual relationship. We contracted to loan $58 million under certain circumstances, and they agreed to pay it back at the most basic level.
That's true so far as it goes, but the allegations are that somehow the rules got changed, or at least there was an understanding the rules got changed, and people trying to react in good faith to what they thought the rules had been changed, spent more money on upgrades, and therefore when it came time, for instance, to say, well, you're out of money, we're not going to give you any more money. They felt they were forced into this by bad faith representations of your client.
Well, under the Stouffer case in Colorado, when those allegations, I might be mispronouncing it, S-T-A-U-F-F-E-R, those allegations must be disregarded because they are entirely contradictory to at least four different agreements between the parties: the loan agreement, the loan amendments, the pre-negotiation agreements. In all of those agreements, the parties recognize, well, first in the loan amendments, recognize that everything that happened before has now been released. They cannot allege that they were entered into under some sort of fraud or duress because they explicitly say they knowingly and voluntarily entered into them, that there was no fraud or duress, that the threat of under New York law, the threat of a foreclosure cannot be duress. Then a year later, there was one pre-negotiation agreement that was before the March 09 loan agreements, that was in January 09, but a year later in February 2010, the parties enter into another pre-negotiation agreement and again say the only amendment was to the oral modification clause. There's no other requirements.
Did you reference that in your brief, or what significance did you make of the 2010 agreement in your briefs?
We did. It is referenced in the brief.
Yeah. What significance was it? And where is it in your brief? How's that?
I can find the significance of the pre-negotiation agreement is
The 2010.
2010 pre-negotiation agreement is that it is after all of these events occurred, and then explicitly rejects the fact that there were any modifications to the agreement. If there had been an increase in loan amount, or if there had been an agreement to agree to some sort of third-party financing, that would have had to have been in a written modification to the loan agreement. And then what happened in the pre-negotiation agreements is that they explicitly stated that there was no such oral modification. Here, the loan agreements, suffice in any event the loan amendments. The loan amendments, everything that is challenged on appeal happened in 2007, 2008. All these promises leading up to the final disbursement, leading up to Dancing Bear running out of money to build this project, that all happened in 2007, 2008. The parties then start negotiating early 2009 and enter into amendments in March 2009. So at that point, basically it starts, whatever was being said before is then explicitly rejected, released, disavowed by the appellants. And they can't agree to that. There was obviously there was good and valuable consideration, a point that they have not challenged on appeal. They received another $12 million in funds on top of the $58 million that had already been loaned. They received more time to try and complete the project, and that can't be disregarded. That is what West LB contracted to give them more money, which he did not have to do, in exchange for the releases. The pre-negotiation, there was then another there are negotiations continue throughout 2009. There's another pre-negotiation agreement in early 2010, which then just reaffirms everything that has already been said. So to the extent that, which they haven't claimed here.
Was that written as well?
Was
the 2010 agreement written?
Yes. It's a written agreement. It's attached. It's in the record, and there are references to it. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact record saved to memory. But just to close up, I think this case can be summed up by there was a clear set of rights and obligations between the parties, and that was very clearly stated in the loan amendments. There were releases, eliminate all these claims. Judge Nichols, in a 30-page single-spaced opinion, also found multiple other grounds, mostly for why these claims don't work, mostly based on the fact that the appellants knew that they needed a written agreement. They proceeded at their peril. They upgraded the project, even assuming that the lender agreed to upgrade the project with them. They went forward, did not have a written agreement for more money than $58 million, did not have alternative financing, and everything that then happened after that, the foreclosure leading up to where we are now, was permitted under the agreements.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honor, just a few points. The trial court decided to reject Dancing Bear's allegations based on the oral representations in light of the no oral modification provision in the contracts. That decision assumes that a verbal promise or an oral representation can never be binding under New York law. Even when the other party to the contract relies on that conduct or representation and is induced into changing his or her behavior.
Counsel, just to be clear, are you challenging the court's right to look at the actual documents in deciding the motion to dismiss?
I don't challenge the court's looking at the document, no.
Okay.
But what the court did was, under Stouffer, how it was pronounced, if there is a document that contradicts an allegation in the pleading, the court can choose not to accept it as true. My position is that the court improperly applied that principle of law. I believe it applies to simple facts. If the complaint alleges that the contract is between party A and B, and the actual contract says the contract is between parties A and C, the court can say, I'm going not to accept as true the allegation in the complaint. What the lower court did in this case was disregard allegations concerning the party's conduct for close to 2 years based on the no oral modification provision.
And based on the release in the loan amendments. And based on the release in the loan amendments.
Well, not initially in the decision, Your Honor. The only thing that's mentioned is the no oral modification provision. And if the no oral modification provision is waived by the parties, Dancing Bear finds itself exhausting the $58 million with nowhere to go before they sign the loan amendments, before you get to the loan amendments. One other quick point. New York law recognizes that certain situations give rise to a breach, that give rise to a breach of contract can also form the basis for a fraud claim under the special facts doctrine. And we've cited a couple of cases in our opening brief which dealt with the special facts doctrine in a commercial context and held that a fraud claim and a breach of contract claim can coexist together at the pleading stage. We're at the pleading stage. This isn't a motion for summary judgment. We're not at the trial stage yet. We should have a right to go forward and to prove the facts that are in our pleading. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much.
Thank you.